across the galaxy and into your dwelling. It's the Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast that explores every corner of the Star Wars universe.
Gentlemen, if you look out the port side of the ship, you'll be able to stare directly into the great and mighty Maw.
I never thought I'd see a black hole so big.
It really is amazing how Han Solo managed to use the gravitational pull of this behemoth to make the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
Allegedly.
Michael, are you telling me you don't believe the legend of Han Solo's Kessel Run?
I'm skeptical, to say the least. And I think we actually owe it to our listeners to discuss the great parsec controversy at some point in our broadcast. But right now, I'm just concerned about the condition of our precious cargo.
Bro, how many times do I have to tell you? Those data pads are basically indestructible. When are you going to believe me?
Sorry if I'm a little paranoid, Al. It's taken us months, hundreds of light speed jumps, searching planets high and low, talking to everyone in every kind of watering hole and cantina to gather the knowledge contained on those D-pads. Who could blame me for being a little concerned that CB's supposed shortcut to Coruscant might damage them in transit?
Ah, fair point. But the runners have used this route to smuggle illegal information for many a cycle now without any issues. It's really the only way to keep it out of the hands of the Empire.
To ensure information and knowledge is kept safe so that we may kindle the spark that lights the fire for future generations. I know the Kessel Runner's creed inside and out, Al, but that doesn't mean I won't get a little stressed every time we pass by one of the galaxy's largest, monstrous black holes. CB!
Bro, okay, you need to get your mind off the little bumps and humps here. Lower that blood pressure a little bit, and I know just the thing.
Al, I know we're close to Kessel, but I'm really not into spice anymore.
Dude, not spice. And trust me, I remember what you used to be like on that stuff, so definitely steering clear of that. No, I'm talking about a transmission.
Oh, yeah, but about what?
Well, here in the Kessel trade route, it would make sense that we talk about the infamous ship that blazed this shortcut in the first place.
Beautiful idea, Al. Let's do it.
Transmitting in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Smuggler's Dispatch, a podcast where we explore every inch of the Star Wars galaxy one topic at a time. I'm Michael Howarth.
And I'm Alex Stewart. And in this episode, we're exploring the most famous vessel this side of Corellia.
That's right. We're going to explore the storied history of the creation of the Millennium Falcon.
Arguably one of my favorite ships in all of Star Wars.
You and millions of other fans, Al. But the story behind this popular ship may actually not be as well known as the ship itself.
So, without any further ado, let's explore the story of the creation of the Millennium Falcon.
All right.
So Michael, I didn't know much about the Millennium Falcon before exploring the information in this episode, other than the fact that I loved it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if maybe this is just common knowledge to a lot of Star Wars fans out there, but apparently the story of the Millennium Falcon all starts with a hamburger?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit before the hamburger, but the hamburger's where it really starts hitting the ground running.
That's actually how I started my autobiography.
With a hamburger?
It's a little bit before that, but the hamburger's really what started to hit the ground running.
That's the hook. That's what they put on the inside of the sleeve.
And it's going to be called My Unhealthy Journey with Obsession with Food by Alex Stewart. So the information that I found this, the website that I found a lot of this information on is one called kitbashed.com. Michael, are you familiar with kitbashed.com? It seems like something you would troll a lot.
You know, I think I followed a few links to kitbash.com from the RPF, but I am not a member of kitbash.com, but I'm familiar with kitbashing in general, which is where you take parts and pieces from other models and then build your own custom creations with those.
Yes,
which
yes,
I
that is what,
is what that is about.
Yeah, kitbashing is something that's very popular, friends out there listening. If you're not quite sure what kitbashing is, I would look up Adam Savage's coverage on kit bashing because he did it for ILM. And with that you can see he's got a great story on, and I think we talked about this on our last season in our Halcyon episode. We talk about his origins of the Greebly. So go check that out. But that's what kit bashing is. So this article on the website gives some amazingly detailed information about this. So before we go into the controversial topic about a hamburger starting this whole thing, we need to go way, way back. Now, Michael, George Lucas was having one heck of a time with the conceptualization of the vessel that Han Solo would fly in his new space western movie.
We got the pirate ship, right? Is that where we're headed towards?
Yeah. So basically what happened, and we're going to be posting some of this stuff on our social media and probably over on our website. There's some amazing sketches that George Lucas did just off the cuff of some of the initial designs for some of these ships. Now, one thing that I think is really interesting is We see George Lucas and company at this time really leaning into this concept of a Western. And that's why you have this old, dilapidated, dusty world that's been created, because it is quite literally a space Western. I mean, honestly, that's what I love about The Mandalorian, is The Mandalorian has finally accepted that concept. Whereas before that, really the best space Western of all time is Firefly.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Michael, have you watched Firefly all the way through? I don't think we've ever talked about this.
Yeah. You know, I have. I've watched it a couple times. I watched it like 10 years ago. I watched through the whole series with my mom. And then just recently, Val had never seen it. So we watched it together. And we just finished Serenity, the movie, after that first season. Just like last week. And I had totally forgotten Serenity, like the movie itself. The movie's really good.
Miranda. Yeah, whenever I hear that name, that's all I think of.
The intrigue.
Listeners, if you have not watched Serenity, start with Firefly. It's only 14 episodes, and it was canceled after that. It was Joss Whedon's first big thing that he did. It's got some amazing power players in there. Yeah. As far as actors go, and the story is just phenomenal. Imagine what they could do if Firefly was rebooted right now. It would be unstoppable.
Yeah.
But anyway, I totally digress there. So, Michael, you talked about the pirate ship. Explain where this pirate ship came from. This label pirate ship.
Yeah, so George Lucas just sketching things out on a simple yellow legal pad, which is, it's so funny how a lot of these iconic things are born out of such simple initial sketches. Like if you look at like J.J. Abrams' ideas for BB-8, it's literally just a napkin with two circles. It's like, I'm thinking of like a ball droid, like a circle on top of it. And George Lucas is like, I like this hamburger. Let's do something with the hamburger, like handing these incredibly simple like silhouettes to ILM. And then they just make absolute magic out of it.
And it's incredible because you see on this legal pad that they have the original designs of X-Wing fighters, and they look exactly like X-Wing fighters.
Yeah.
And so you've got these labeled as an X-Wing fighter. Also on that legal pad, you have one that is labeled as a blockade runner, which looks very familiar. And then you have one that is just labeled pirate ship.
Yep.
And this thing looks like a long cylinder. And it feels a lot more like a traditional spaceship would look. Have you seen these sketches, Michael? I don't know if you've checked these out. I need to share these with you.
Yeah, I have. They honestly look a little bit more like real world. They look like something that NASA could have created. You know, like the scaffolding and kind of raw and like just a little bit less greebled, I guess. A little bit less complicated, overly engineered, you know, science fiction fantasy like Star Wars works with.
I think that there's a big reason for that is, we can actually talk about him right now. Colin Cantwell, who was a crazy talented designer who was working with George Lucas at the time, actually worked with Stanley Kubrick previously here. And so with 2001 A Space Odyssey that came out in 1968, you see Cantwell's, a lot of Cantwell's signature designs from that film coming over to these early designs of Star Wars ships and locations in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what you see here, is Colin Cantwell would start the initial building of the models that George Lucas would use, not only of this pirate ship, but of an entire fleet of ships, to sell the concept to film execs. So they would go in and he would actually present these and say, this is kind of what we're thinking about creating. So a lot of people always point back to Ralph McQuarrie as kind of like the mastermind of these things. But Colin Cantwell, if you look at the history, Colin Cantwell was doing this a number of months before McQuarrie even came on board. And so if we look at the heritage here and the design, it actually starts with Cantwell's designs from Lucas that then McQuarrie picks up and creates these incredible concept drawings. Have you seen these concept drawings, Michael?
I have, yeah. McQuarrie's drawings, you mean, of the Falcon?
Yes, of the original Falcon known as the pirate ship.
Yes, yeah, it's crazy. It's funny to see how different this all looks. And it's cool, too, because I'm pretty sure that this is visualized in the graphic novelization, The Star Wars, which is built off of the script that George Lucas had originally written, you know, the first few drafts of it. So you get to see the crazy, weird plans that they originally had. Like, I think Jabba the Hutt was a smuggler alongside Han that was a human that was like on the Falcon. There was a bunch of crazy stuff. It was way different.
It's like a fever dream when you read that. I picked it up at a Comic-Con like 7 years ago. Oh, yeah. But that's even worse because, well, not worse, but even more feverish because you've got all these characters that have weird names, but they also link back. I highly recommend it. Well, actually, we should do an episode.
Oh, I'd love
specifically
to.
About the Star Wars.
We really should.
So, yeah. So once this kind of, once the ball got rolling, once they got the green light for this, then they hire on Ralph McQuarrie and McQuarrie puts his amazing visual skills to creating the look of this pirate ship. One of the things that we see McQuarrie doing primarily, and this there's good reason for this, he's focusing primarily on the cockpit here, and a lot of his designs came from, well, I should say, Michael, talk about what the inspiration for that cockpit came from for the Falcon.
So, like, a lot of the things and a lot of the props and sets that were designed for Star Wars in 1975-76 comes from World War II. So a famous B-52 bomber cockpit is where he drew his inspiration for the view outside of the window and, like, where you would sit and pilot the Falcon itself, which is very iconic. And when you see a B-52 bomber cockpit, it's hard not to be reminded of the Millennium Falcon, even though it's like the other way around.
Yeah.
Like, the Falcon is almost more ubiquitous than that real world ship is or plane.
When you said that, all I could think about is, if you see a painted sign on the side of the road that says 15. Do you know who that is? It's irony. It's amazing that you layered this. Michael, you didn't realize that you made such a nuanced reference there. Do you know what band that is?
Nope, I have zero clue. Tell me.
Please. The B-52s.
Oh, the B-52s. I knew the B-52s were a band, but
yeah, and they sing Love Shack, and that's how it starts. When you said,
if you see this
cockpit, yes, exactly. And so you set that up perfectly. Michael, you are channeling my references,
up,
and you're not even realizing that's
impressive.
Yeah,
Dyad in the Force, you know? That's what I'm here for. I don't even know what I'm doing. Dude, it's kind of funny that McQuarrie was like doing concept art after Colin Cantwell had started building a miniature for the Falcon, which is like usually totally backwards from how they normally do it. But it almost fits with the character of the Millennium Falcon, like who the ship is, you know, that it's been cobbled together and kitbashed and greebled, and that it used to be something else and now it's something different, and now it's a smuggling ship and it's been pieced together by Han and Chewie, and like, I don't know. It's real world history is just very aligned with the characters that inhabit it.
Well, and I think one of the things to piggyback off of that fascinates me about this is it is one of the first things to come out of George Lucas's mind and so he understood the importance of this specific ship. And as a result, it started at the very beginning. And it is crazy that, again, I think that the main reason why those were designs were dimensionalized and not concepted first is because George Lucas was really smart to be able to give something physical and tangible to be able to help conceptualize this world. Because if you don't have something that you can look at in 360 degrees, and again, this goes to show why something like a Galaxy's Edge is so popular, is because George Lucas has this amazing ability to immerse you, and it's just innate. Mm-hmm. You can see that is just second nature for him to be able to create a model to show off what he's thinking inside of his head, which just shows how much of a visionary he really was.
Oh, definitely.
In this medium.
Yeah, and to trust those people to translate his dream and his vision, which he did. He was always confident in other people's abilities, which is really cool. And he found some world-class people like Colin Campbell and McQuarrie. They're unbeatable.
Oh, without a doubt. And one of the things that we see is during this entire process, there's a ton of iterations from the beginnings, the primordial first steps, if you will, all the way up to the finished product. Now, the interesting thing is this final design for the pirate ship would actually end up looking exactly like the Blockade Runner, which is the very first ship that we see in the very first frames of A New Hope.
Yep.
It's the ship that's getting blasted by the Imperial Star Cruiser that's housing Leia and 3PO and R2.
Yep.
And one thing that I think is awesome, I love this, that this is such a heritage throughout, that long cylindrical shape with the 11 engines powering the ship, you see that throughout everything. That is such a staple in Star Wars Star Cruiser design.
Yep. And it's kind of ironic, too, because Lucas wanted it to kind of feel like a hot rod, like this really sleek engine heavy thing, and like that it's super fast and that it would just scream through the galaxy, and that it's just being absolutely like caught up with by this super slow Star Destroyer behind it. It's just bumbling through the galaxy.
And it's amazing to see the design of this ship is so very familiar. When you look at it, it legit does look like the ballet sequence from 2001 A Space Odyssey. It looks like it was a ship that was left over from that set, which I would say is not necessarily an absolutely unique design. And there's something interesting about this because this ship that they created that was the long cylinder with 11 engines behind and powering it was actually obviously not what they used for the Millennium Falcon because there was a giant issue that arose. And Michael, what was that issue?
So after they had built this thing, and it was like 6 feet long. I mean, Colin Campbell.
It was 7 feet.
Seven feet long.
A beast.
Like his whole team, when they were done with it, it is the model you see in Star Wars. This massive, awesome ship. But there was a TV show coming out at the time called Space 1999 that has not aged as well as Star Wars, but it had a ship in it that looked very similar to the Tantive IV, to this Rebel Blockade Runner that they had initially planned to be the Millennium Falcon. And Lucas just didn't want to be compared to anything else, really. So he kind of sent them back to the drawing board.
And one of the things that you see here that I was reading is fascinating is at this time, television was obviously seen as an inferior medium. Mm. And one of George Lucas's big fears with this is he was afraid that if people saw his ship, they would think that he was emulating something that he saw on a lowly medium like television. So he wanted the respect to be there. So he decided that instead of continuing down this path, the ship known as the Eagle in this show called Space 1999 was way too similar to his pirate ship. Yeah. And so essentially they went right back to the drawing board, and George Lucas was like, we start over from the very beginning.
Which was a good choice. But this is coming from the guy who basically wanted to remake Flash Gordon and made Star Wars because he couldn't get the licensing for Flash Gordon. Like, even have you seen the crawl, the opening crawl for Flash Gordon?
I haven't, actually.
It is this crawl from Star Wars. That's where he got it from. Like, it's funny that he did that, but he was so adamant about not having the ship from Space 1999, which is probably because it was contemporary. It was coming out at the same time, but I just think that's hilarious. He's like, well, it's about the Saturday morning cartoon serials, and it is basically...
Which, I mean, if you think about it, it's incredible when you read Edgar Rice Burroughs' series. I don't know if you've read any of the John Carter series, Michael. But
I haven't, no.
When you read through some of the John Carter books, it's absolutely shocking. And truthfully, this is the interesting thing. Did you watch the movie John Carter back in the day?
No, I didn't. The one that Disney made?
Yeah.
No, yeah. I wanted to. So it looked interesting.
There's a big reason why it bombed. And the big reason is everybody said this is a ripoff of Star Wars. And the interesting thing is Star Wars is a massive ripoff of the John Carter series.
Edgar Rice Burroughs just rolling over 1,000 times in his grave. No, it's Mark!
Exactly. So for people who may not know that name out there, Edgar Rice Burroughs was actually a contemporary of people like, even before that, H.G. Wells was actually
was
one
say.
Of his contemporaries. Mm-hmm. And Edgar Rice Burroughs was primarily known for his series about a man raised by apes by the name of Tarzan.
Mm-hmm.
But he was deep into this new burgeoning concept of space travel. And so one of his characters goes to Mars, which this is interesting historical tidbit here, friends. And Michael, I don't know if we've never really talked about this, but this actually came out of the time at the turn of the 20th century from the 19th century. There was actually a very prominent scientific theory that Mars actually had a very large population of sentient beings on it. And that's because one of the most powerful telescopes that we had at the time was able to be pointed at Mars, and it appeared to us from our earthly standpoint that there was a lot of road infrastructure created on the surface of Mars. And so as a result, a lot of these people started saying, oh, well, let's see if we can go visit the Martians, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So Edgar Rice Burroughs comes out and is like, well, let's take you there in the form of a novel. And he creates this series about a guy who goes up there and meets a race of very wise beings known as the Jeddax.
I didn't know that. They're called the Jeddax.
Yeah, J-E-D-A-K. They are a Jeddak.
Jeddak. Interesting. Yep. That's hilarious. Yep. Are those the ones with the tusks? I remember them from the trailer.
Yes, they almost look like a Geonosian.
Oh,
in a lot of ways.
Oh, interesting. The plot thickens yet again.
Yeah, which is kind of fascinating. So, sorry, I don't even know how we sidetracked there. But
that's great.
Where did we get off on that topic? But that was an absolute tangent. Oh, because we were talking about ripoffs. We were talking about,
inspiration. Flash Gordon, yep.
Yeah, well, George Lucas was...
It's exciting, though. Mars, you know? I mean, it does look like the roadways leading to Rome. Like, it makes a lot of sense. You look at Mars and you can totally see why people would believe that. And was that, I mean, how close was that to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds radio broadcast?
Well, so H.G. Wells actually didn't live to see the broadcast. So the radio broadcast came out in the mid-1930s, and it was produced by, it was the Mercury Theater, or the Mercury Players Theater of the Air. Which was actually produced by Orson Welles.
So Orson Welles, I'm an idiot. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking of Orson Welles this whole time. Yeah, that's all.
Orson Welles actually, ironically, has no relation to H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
So H.G. Wells was around the turn of the 19th century, and
he
created War of the Worlds, and he created the Time Machine, and so he was kind of one of the forebearers of modern science fiction.
Yeah.
That's what I think is incredible about John Carter, is you see this happening, almost 100 years before we even make it to the moon. So
that's pretty crazy.
There's a ton of speculation going on around this time, but there really is an absolute obsession going on with space travel during that time. I would love for us to explore on an episode the primordial influences of science fiction and fantasy that lead to Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because there is so much gleaned from that, especially when you look at things like Méliès' A Voyage to the Moon.
Yes.
You get a lot of Lucas's influences from the first science fiction film ever made.
And Metropolis. There's so much. And Dune.
All the way through
not
the
talk
ages.
About Dune. Holy cow.
Which I still have not read all the way through, Michael.
Dude, I'll read it to you. When you're going to bed, your kids are listening to Adventures in Odyssey, I'll be on FaceTime reading you Dune.
Adventures in, what's the name of the planet
Kwisatz
that they go
Haderach. To? The planet Arrakis. Adventures in Arrakis.
I'm a little scared of it. I'm like, it's so big. It's so beefy.
It's a dense one, yeah.
Yeah.
The second time you read it, it's like, okay, this all makes more sense. But the first time you read it, you're just like completely lost. You're like, why? What are these words? Why is this important? Why is there so many words?
And maybe I should ask you this while we're not recording, because this doesn't have anything to do with our topic. But is it okay to watch the movie first to get kind of a primer and then read the book? Or would you like highly recommend against that?
I would not highly recommend against that. Denis Villeneuve is the greatest adaptation director of all time. He did an amazing job. You could totally watch the movie. And it is fun to like I like adaptations, and it's cool to have something to go into a book with a visual like image of it, of like who the characters are and stuff, especially because the second part is still yet to come out. So you wouldn't be fully, like, you wouldn't get the whole entire thing. You could watch the movie and then get excited and then read the book, have a little context, finish the book, and then you'll be ready to go into part two. Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. That sounds like a nice little aperitif, a little hors d'oeuvres, if you will.
Hors d'oeuvres.
Or as we've talked about previously in the podcast, a delicious amuse-bouche.
Amuse-bouche? I'll tell you. There was an amuse-bouche on a menu I saw recently, and I was like, I know that. Sorry. Okay.
This podcast has educated one person. That's great. That's
and
great.
And it's me. All right, Al.
All right.
Let's get back in here. You're usually the one to write the train. I'm sorry that I don't write the train when.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I got you off track here. So one of the things that I find fascinating about this is George Lucas dumped $25,000 worth of cash into the making of this 7-foot long model of the pirate ship. And so to put that into perspective, that is 1/3 of their total model building budget for the entire movie.
That's insane. The Tantive IV, a ship that like a casual Star Wars fan probably doesn't even know about.
Well, so Michael keeps bringing up the Tantive IV, and everybody's like, wait, but we're talking about the Millennium Falcon. But that's exactly where this falls together.
Right.
So the Tantive IV was originally going to be a different blockade runner ship. But because this ship was $25,000 to build and it had 400 cycles of electronics built throughout the entire thing, they were like, we can't like not use this thing. We are required. Yeah. We are bound by morality to use this thing. And so what do they do? They use it instead of the Millennium Falcon or the quote-unquote pirate ship. They use it as the blockade runner at the very beginning. So this is the cool thing. What you're seeing at the very beginning of A New Hope is the original Millennium Falcon. And I find that to be fascinating.
That's true. That is cool when you put it that way. When you put that so succinctly. It is awesome. And $25,000, it's insane. Also, like, it's hard to wrap your mind around nowadays, but you're saying, you know, what was it, 400 cycles of electronics or whatever running through that. Like, this is before LEDs. Like, the light-emitting diode had not been invented yet. This is 1975.
Each one of those is an incandescent.
Yeah, this is a hot 7 feet of plastic and wood and glue. They had just discovered super glue while they were building these things. Like, they literally didn't even have super glue as they were building the models. Like, there was a dude that got hired. I'm trying to remember his name. He's one of the model makers. It's in the Light and Magic documentary. But he brought super glue because he worked at a factory, because you couldn't actually buy super glue as a consumer at that point in time.
It was
so
like,
he brought
it was
this
like
stuff.
Industrial grade.
Right, yeah. So he was like, check out this cryoanalyte glue, CA glue. It would like dry in a second, and like everybody like was blown away that they didn't have to hold a little piece on there for like 5 minutes to wait for the epoxy to set, that they could just glue it with super glue. Like, this,
I had
it's
no
hard
clue about that.
To wrap your brain around like 7 feet of this thing built that way.
That's incredible. We have to, again, this is what our conversations do, is we have to have an episode focused on the art and design of model building, because it's fascinating. Well, and so with this, one of the things that we see is, yes, it's true that the first ship that you see on screen is the Millennium Falcon, but it does have a minute detail change, which I think changes it for the better. And it was created using two paint buckets. And what they did is they created the front of the Tantive IV, which, fun fact, friends, we all know this ship, at least deep Star Wars nerds know this ship as the Tantive IV, but it is never referenced in the film, and it is never referenced in any subsequent film as the Tantive IV. Yep. So that's apocryphal, that was canonized down the line. But they took the cockpit off of that and then put those buckets on to create. So they took out the B-52 design because George Lucas was like, I've got ideas for this. And so he put that aside and put these two buckets on the front. And that's how we get the original Tantive IV, which just blows my mind.
And I'm looking at pictures of it right now, and like, it's so sick. The Tantive IV is really dope too. And I actually never noticed this. Sorry if this is in your notes later on in the episode, Al, but those two buckets that make up this hammerhead piece at the front of it, that, you're right, it does. It totally changes it. It totally brings it out of the world of reality and into the world of science fiction fantasy. But those bucket ends look exactly like the two circular pieces in the center of the hamburger that stick out of the sides. They're actually the escape pods on the Falcon. Like, it looks very similar. So you can see where there's some inspiration still taken from the blockade runner that was originally made, that's used in the Falcon model as well.
And I did not even think about that. I like having your eyes on these things, Howarth.
And sorry, this is kind of, sorry, that was a bit of a visual digression for this audio format.
No, but I think that, again, if somebody's looking at our visual catalog that you can see on our Instagrams and on our website, to be able to accompany this, it tracks. Without a doubt tracks. So basically what we've done here is we've realized that George Lucas had a very strong vision for this pirate ship from the very start. Mm-hmm. And once he executed that, as things go, he had to abandon it because this space 1999. And so now again, they are back at the drawing board. So this is where the infamous hamburger tale comes in. Now, there's probably a lot of, well, I should say we have 7 listeners, and one of them is our, like, our deep Star Wars nerd out there who's like, well, actually, gentlemen, may I butt in?
Talking smack on a high percentage of our listeners if those numbers are correct.
That is true. I'm talking to roughly 17% of our listeners is the Star Wars nerd. But what they're saying right now is, I don't know about the accuracy of this hamburger tale that you're talking about. Michael, have you heard this legend about the hamburger before?
I have heard the legend of the hamburger, and it's a bit of a myth, you know, which fits into the mythos of Star Wars.
Here's my question is, what version did you hear? Because there's many versions of this, which is interesting.
So I heard that George Lucas saw a burger or was eating a burger. I didn't hear about the plane thing. I didn't hear this, that he was on a plane, but he's eating a burger and he like arranged an olive next to the burger, which I don't know what kind of burger he was eating that would have had olives with it.
Well, back in the day, you used to get like a toothpick in the top of your burger to hold it together, and it had an olive on the top of it.
Yeah, I just got like an image of like the clip art of like a burger with like a like a little red vegetable like an olive. You're right.
That weird plasticky little, like that plasticky foil that they would put on top of the toothpick. So for some reason, it made it look more festive.
Yeah, yeah. It was like a troll doll hair. The troll hair thing. Yeah, at the end of the toothpick. Yep. So Lucas is looking at his toothpick and his olive, and he arranged it next to the burger and was like, make something like that. And they were like, okay. But I don't know.
So yeah, that's one of the biggest versions out there is that George Lucas was eating the burger himself and saw it. Yeah. But then there's also variations like I have here also in the notes that say that he was riding on a plane and either he or somebody else on the plane was eating a burger.
Right.
And that's where it all kind of went down.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who will say that this story is not true. And here's the thing that I find interesting about these stories is there has to be at least some element of truth to it. if there wasn't some element of truth to it, it would not have become the quick access story that it was. With the way that the human brain works, there has to be some element of connectivity to it.
Yeah.
Because let's be honest, it's far too absurd for it to be a made up story.
That is true. I could see that, especially because it looks more like a flying saucer than anything.
That is
more plausible as like an explanation for where it came from. So, you know, stranger than fiction, the truth here, the burger.
The Bergs. But also George Lucas was not necessarily I'm going to talk about that later.
Okay. I regress
back to this idea of that story probably isn't exactly how it went down. But I do think that that does have some elements of truth in it. Really, what matters is the fact that George Lucas and I have something in common, and that's our best ideas come from half-eaten food that we've devoured.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your best half-eaten food idea, Al?
This podcast, Michael. So do you know what I was eating while I was thinking up this podcast?
I'm going to guess you had like some Flamin' Hot Cheetos and you were trying to smuggle them onto a plane across security without dumping them out.
That's close. I actually had 18 peanut M&Ms and I wasn't allowed to take food on a flight, so I stuffed them down into my cheeks as though I was Marlon Brando from The Godfather, and
or
I walked
squirrel.
Through. Oh, but the visual, maybe a squirrel. Yeah, I guess the squirrel and Marlin look the same. So I walked in through security, and I was like, no, just had face surgery. And oddly enough, they didn't check my bags. They didn't check anything. They just let me through because they knew I was a godfather.
That's good. That's good.
And so it was at that moment that I realized, man, this podcast has to be about smugglers. And I was listening to a very specific college rock band while walking through there. Do you know what the name of the band is that I was listening to?
I don't know. Weezer? I'm not sure.
No, it was a college rock, Michael, like a Dave Matthews variant. It was actually the band Dispatch. Yeah.
Dispatch. Oh, okay. You realize that was college rock then, but it's just dad rock now to help
it's
you.
It's not
with
even
your...
dad rock. It's like elderly rock now. Oh, the guys in Dispatch are like their mid 50s, I think.
The
and I'm like, oh man.
Rock.
The Elden Rock is what I'm going to call it from now on. So that story took 4 minutes, and none of it was true. Listeners, well, yeah. I'm sorry.
I have a true story about smuggling. Then I used to. So
oh gosh,
we had a dollar theater. It sounds more epic than it is, but we had a dollar movie theater in Colorado Springs, and like. You know, they wouldn't let you bring snacks in because they make all of their money off of the concessions, but they're so
That's
expensive.
That's the only way they make money, yeah.
Which is kind of horrible of me in retrospect, but we used to go to the dollar store next to the theater, next to the dollar. We were high rollers.
Poor planning, Colorado
but
Springs.
But we would grab 2 liters of soda, and I would shove them down my pants, and then I would just go through the line, and you look insane. But, like, nobody's going to, like, point there and be like, excuse me, sir, like.
Were you wearing, like, JNCOs? Like, something very balloony?
The worst part is these were, like, at that point in time, these were probably stretchy, tight girl pants. Because this was before you could buy tight jeans at H&M. So I'm wearing, like, these personally hemmed. That's how I learned to sew, Al.
Diesels.
That's where my
you were wearing Diesels, bro.
Yeah, exactly. So in these really stretchy pants, I could just shove a whole 2 liter down there. But it's like, nobody's going to ask that question. You know, they don't want to start that conversation.
That is true. That is true. Especially with some dude in high school. You don't really,
right.
You don't ask questions. Oh my gosh. That's an amazing story. Oh, and now you just smuggle in kombucha.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
the funny irony of life now
exactly.
where we're at. I've got to get a good antioxidant. So the shape concept stands, this circular disc-like shape, but George Lucas, it's kind of murky if Lucas was excited about a saucer shape or if he was against the saucer shape, Michael. I couldn't find a definitive understanding as to what his thoughts were on the actual shape of a saucer. Have you heard this controversy?
No, I haven't. And yeah, I'm not sure how this all panned out because I think at this point in the game, it was like crunch time. Like people were drawing.
Yes.
Joe Johnston was building and drawing, you know, Colin Cantwell's modeling, like Ralph McQuarrie's doing 1,000 things. I think it was kind of just this chaos that birthed this genius, perfect thing out of it. But
well,
sure.
And I think that. Yeah, I think that that's the interesting thing that you bring up is the idea of being in a crunch time, under the gun of mm-hmm. sorts, under the blaster, if you will. And with this, what we see is, so there is the designer, Joe Johnston, who takes this idea that George Lucas says, whether it's a burger with an olive or not, because even Joe Johnston was like, I don't remember anything about a burger.
Right.
And so
he's
a great resource on this to be like, that's not
right.
Really what I remember. But what Joe Johnston remembers is that Lucas brought the idea of a radial design.
Uh-huh.
But he, again, there's controversy as to if Lucas liked the radial concept but wanted to stay away from a flat saucer. Mm-hmm. Because what he also envisioned was that this thing would fly like a sunfish. So that means that it was flat, but it would fly sideways
mm-hmm.
where the flat, so it wasn't like a flying saucer. It was more of like a, like, I don't even know how to describe that. It's
like a
the falcon.
Or a stingray.
No, like a sunfish. So a sunfish, from my understanding, isn't it the big flat fish that looks?
You're right.
It looks like an open hand, like turned on its side.
You're right. I was thinking
side.
Of the wrong fish.
Yeah. And that's what I think is really cool about this concept is imagine I think in Star Trek there are space vessels that are like this. You know what? So to think about it, almost the shape that you see of Darth Maul's spear on Tatooine. Yes. Uh-huh. So that's very similar. Or the things that they ride on Geonosis, like that's like a one big single wheel. Am I thinking correctly with that? Don't they ride something that's got a big
Grievous.
Wheel?
Oh, there is a droid. Yeah, there is a droid that does that. What? Yeah, one of the units has like a big wheel. I'm not remembering exactly what it is, but yeah, that's true. Also, the B-wing is kind of a vertical type of ship.
Yeah, I like this idea of a flat disc flying sideways, though.
Right.
I think there's some on its edge, which is super cool. So Joe Johnston takes that concept that George Lucas throws out there, and Joe Johnston was like, "I'm definitely not going to do the flying saucer thing. The flying saucer is overdone. It's not worth it, and we don't have time to play around." So in one single day, listeners, one single day, Joe Johnston comes in and says, "Here you go. This is what I've got." And it's basically the exact Millennium Falcon that we see today, which is crazy to me that here they spend months and thousands of dollars and multiple iterations to come up with this original concept. And then they basically just spit out this new Millennium Falcon, which is just so awesome and so true to the creative process.
Dude, and I mean, Joe Johnston is a concept artist. Like he's just like, okay, I'll make the model. Like, he's amazing. He's also a director. He's also a writer. Like, he did The Rocketeer. What else? He did like Hidalgo. I just pulled up his Wikipedia. Like, he's all over the place. It's crazy. Like, he wanted to leave Lucasfilm because he was so burnt out. I don't know if it was after Empire or Jedi, but he wanted to leave because he was just so tired of all the work. And George Lucas was like, "You are really good at storytelling and like what you do is like a part of this world." So I think he paid for him to go to film school. Like he was just like, "I tell you what, I'll pay for everything for you to go to film school." And like, cause he just wanted him to stay in this industry cause he thought he was such a good voice, and he did. And he came out of that. And now he's a writer director, like incredibly successful. Like, it's crazy. Like, he just wanted him to succeed and like, you know, just helped him out.
That's insane. I didn't know anything about that. I didn't realize that this Joe Johnston was that Joe Johnston.
Yeah. The guy who made
that he was the director.
Millennium Falcon. Also that's, the Rocketeer.
That's awesome, which is a great, great movie.
Yep.
BT Dubs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and so what Joe Johnston did is he took those concepts and he cut that chunk out of the middle so it wouldn't be just like a saucer-like shape. And then he essentially reattached the B-52 cockpit onto the side. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was going to be on the top of the saucer like a traditional saucer.
Right.
But instead, he was like, nope, forget that. Let's put it on the side here. And let's put a satellite dish on the top, because there was a satellite dish. This is a throwback to the original Tantive IV design. There was a satellite dish on top. But here's the crazy thing is, again, we go back and we see that George Lucas was a little bit on, I should say, I don't want to say hypocritical, but I want to say that George Lucas was very particular about one thing, but didn't have his vision set on 2001: A Space Odyssey. Because, again, I keep bringing this up, and listeners, please go back and watch 2001: A Space Odyssey, and you see that the main ship that's got the big ball on the front that then goes on to be used as the inspiration for the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy spaceship that they fly through, that design of that ship looks so much like the original pirate ship / Tantive IV, and it's got a big old satellite dish right on the back. And George Lucas was like, "We keep the satellite dish on the new one."
Exactly.
So it's really funny to see the things that he was like, "We're not doing Space 99 here. We have to do our own thing." Yet he keeps the satellite dish, which I've got to say, without the satellite dish, the Millennium Falcon makes no sense to me. It just loses its flair.
Well, it's a good visual balance to the weight of how it looks, for sure. And oh man, Dude, I'm just thinking about like watching behind the scenes videos on the Millennium Falcon. It like weirdly makes you emotional. Like, yeah, I don't know if you feel the same way.
Share.
But like just watching like the scenes of it flying around, and like it is the home for so many of our characters. Like, it is the place that people come back, you know, like Han says, like, Chewie, we're home. I don't know, like it just embodies so much of like what the essence of Star Wars is to me, that like even just seeing it just triggers so much nostalgia and memory and like feelings. It just like makes you misty-eyed. I love it.
I can absolutely understand and level with that when you look at it, there is such a familiarity that, yeah, It's almost just in our DNA. And the thing that's amazing about it is, just like we were talking about earlier with Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, there are certain things that are such, we use this word a lot on this podcast, so iconic, but there are very few true icons out there. We overuse that word because I just love it. But when we look at the pure form of an icon, when you see Citizen Kane, the movie is very dull. But when you watch it for the cinematics, the movie is brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you see the cinematography in that, you realize that it is of such a caliber that anybody else who were to try to touch it or come even close or even mirror it a little bit, it wouldn't be an homage. It would be a mockery, is what people would approach that with, because it is almost the divine. It is the holiest of holies when you look at something like Citizen Kane to a cinematographer.
Yeah.
But then, and it's the same way with that shape of the Millennium Falcon. Nobody touches it.
Yeah.
Nobody 100%. Comes close, because it is such a true icon in its design.
And much like Citizen Kane, as more time goes on, it becomes harder and harder to appreciate its genius. Because you watch a movie like Citizen Kane, and I don't know a ton about the technical cinematography behind it, but I know that like there's these shots from really low to the ground where I think they had to remove parts of the set so the camera
they cut
could
they
sit.
Cut the floor out
so they could get this incredibly dramatic shot of like different characters that kind of would convey power or weakness or their emotional state, which I don't think the view for the audience through the lens had ever been a way to reflect how a character feels before, right?
So the Citizen Kane kind of perfected that. There were people who had played with that and toyed with that idea, without a doubt. Yeah. But interestingly enough, 25-year-old Orson Welles, who had never made a film before, saw the capability of conveying dramatic understanding and storytelling through that lens and perfected it, without a doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, which is awesome. And like, sorry, all that to say, this is a massive aside, but all of, like, when you watch it now, you're like, this is boring, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you don't even realize that had never been done before. Like, so many things had never been done before, which is the same way with the Falcon. Like, the asymmetry of the creation, like, is not the first time it's ever been done, but it's the first time it's been done to that effect, like, that well. And the fact that, you know, even the Greeblies, even the fact that it's got crap on the outside of it, like rather than this shored up, perfect, you know, space shell on the outside, like that had never been done before. And like so many things have taken from that. It's crazy nowadays, but.
Well, and you look at even when you look at the design of the engines, that it's got that crescent shape on the back.
Ugh.
That right there is such a forward thinking concept. From this 1977 vision, because again, that barrel design of rockets, that's all we do even to this day. Yet you've got this amazingly flat back to the Falcon that just gives it so you were talking earlier, Michael, about how George Lucas wanted this original pirate ship to be a hot rod.
Right.
Joe Johnston perfected that concept. Yeah. I mean, the Millennium Falcon is a hot rod.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And And also, too, I feel like the part of the reason that it works so well in grounding it as a Star Wars ship rather than a real world ship, because like you look at the Tantive IV and you're talking about how before they added those hammer bucket head things on the front, that it looked a little too streamlined, too real, too NASA, whatever. But similarly, adding the cockpit on the side of the disc shape is such a good idea because it's totally disregarding aerodynamics because it doesn't have to worry about it. So it I think when you see something that's aerodynamic, it like kind of brings you to Earth a little bit, maybe. Like it puts your brain in like an
in
analytical
gravity
mode. Yeah, whereas like the Millennium Falcon just like throws all of that practicality out the window, which is perfect. That's exactly how Star Wars should be.
And that's what I love about Star Wars being fantasy and not science fiction, because science fiction has to be grounded in some reality. Right. Star Wars doesn't need that, and I love that Star Wars doesn't need that.
We get fiery explosions in space, and I'll take that any day of the week over the quiet silence. I mean, I love 2001: A Space Odyssey. Don't get me wrong, but there's some quiet scenes in that movie.
Oh yes. But that's what's so awesome about Star Wars is we can take that and we can expand upon it. And that's what I think that these creators did so well is that they were able to because it's pretty impressive when the majority of non-Star Wars fans would say that the most recognizable science fiction film of all time is Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it's not even science fiction. Because that's what I think is so great, is that it fits so well into what people think could be. And this design is such with that. And that's one thing that I wanted to talk about with there's speculation on the name, because there's not a lot known as to why they call it the Millennium Falcon. But there is a theory out there that I think is absolutely hilarious, but could be true. So there's no mistaking the fact that the original ship that came to market first was called the Eagle back in space 1999. Now the Eagle is a bird, it's a raptor, and this show takes place in 1999. So George Lucas decides to call his ship the Millennium, which actually takes it a year further and makes it more intense, and he names his ship the Falcon. Now, is that coincidence? I don't know. Or is that like the ultimate George Lucas diss track?
Dude, that's amazing. I've never heard that before. I knew about Space 1999. I had never put those pieces together, and I didn't know the ship was called the Eagle.
That's so sick,
dude.
Do you think that's coincidence?
There's no way. 1999 to 2000, the Millennium, an Eagle to the Falcon. And that was a part of the conversation since day one was Space 1999. That's 1,000% it. That's amazing.
Again, I can't say that it's absolutely true because it's never been verified. But yes, that is one of the running theories out there, and I think it's great.
It is great. That's fantastic.
And so, really, what we wanted to do with this episode is we wanted to focus it in on the creation, because we were afraid that if we did creation and talked about like in-universe lore and all that kind of stuff, that this episode would be 2.5 hours long, and it would basically water everything down.
True.
And so as we were exploring this episode, listener, as far as research goes, we realized that it only made sense for this to be kind of the introductory episode. Now, the next episode that we go on to probably will not be a Millennium Falcon episode part 2. But down the line, just like we see with a lot of our episodes from season 1, we're going to be able to revisit those topics. And this is one of those that we absolutely have to turn around, because I want to hear Michael's thoughts on the fact that in universe, the Millennium Falcon was basically a tugboat.
Right. And thinking about how it's designed, like its purpose, which is so cool that they took the whole side cockpit thing and turned that into a... a practicality because the center part was like can be used to manipulate and maneuver cargo so you could see around the cargo, like out of the ship, because something was right in front of it. Like there's so many, oh man, there's so much. And dude, also like Galaxy's Edge, I want to talk about the Millennium Falcon at Galaxy's Edge so bad. There's so much stuff about that. Like we could seriously do an entire episode about the Millennium Falcon just at Galaxy's Edge. It's nuts.
Well, and that's one of the fascinating things that you see in the research is for the entire first film, there was never a full Falcon model, like a full-scale Falcon model.
Yeah.
And from my understanding, until Galaxy's Edge, there never was a full-scale Falcon ever built. Is that right?
There has never been a full external one-to-one scale Millennium Falcon ever built until Galaxy's Edge. Yep, that is it. And there's actually a little Easter egg for the future when we talk about that episode. There is a mini Millennium Falcon on the surface, like as a greebly of the Falcon at Galaxy's Edge. There's
it's
a whole
a
Millennium
Falcon.
A hidden Falcon instead of a hidden Mickey. But yeah, that was the first time we get the whole thing one-to-one scale fully built. Because yeah, like when we first see it in A New Hope, that's half of it. It's like literally cut in half, chopped in half.
Yes.
And it's all plywood behind it. But I will say for Solo, though, they did rebuild almost the entirety of the interior as one continuous set, which had never been done before, which is just the coolest thing. Like, I don't know
why
what we're going
to
cover.
Why can't they? Yeah, I was going to say, why can't they open that to the public and let us walk through?
Dude, they did during the premiere.
Stop. Stop. Yeah. Well, regular schleps like us can't go to the premiere, though.
I know. I don't know if it was all of it, but yeah, they built the entire set because if you watch Solo, there are these really long cuts. Well, they're not cuts, but these really long shots where the camera's following characters. And you'll realize you actually never saw the camera follow a character out of the cockpit, into the hallway, into the Dejarik table, into the engine room.
Yeah.
You never see that.
It's a mysterious layout.
Yeah, like you don't continuously see that in any of the original trilogy. But you do see continuous shots out of the cockpit, into the hallway. Like they actually built the whole entire thing for Solo because they wanted the ship itself, obviously, to have a huge presence as its own character in the movie, which it totally does. And dude, the Solo, there's a little featurette on the Falcon on the bonus features of Solo. So if you own it or if you can find it, I don't even know if it's on Disney Plus, but it's really, really good. I think it's only 20 minutes long, but I could talk about Solo's Falcon all day long as well. I love what they did with Lando's version of what the Millennium Falcon originally was. And that's probably part of the in-universe conversation, so I should stop myself now.
You should pump the brakes. Pump it, Chewie. That was me doing a reverse Chewbacca.
Gentlemen,
instead of punching
I don't mean to be a Bespinian rain cloud, but we are about to enter the asteroid field. I highly suggest you cut the transmission and strap yourselves in.
Oh, well, I guess I won't talk about my funny Wookiee joke anymore. Okay, Michael, where can people find us?
People can find us on Instagram, they can find us on YouTube, and they can find us at smugglersdispatch.com. If you search the Smugglers Dispatch, you'll find us on all of those places. We are currently actually kind of migrating some of our season one episodes over to YouTube with some visuals that Al and I have put together. So if you want to watch or listen to your podcasts in that format, then we're going to have all of them over there in the near future here. So we're also working on building up some plans for content that we're going to add behind the scenes as far as prop building, things like that, that's going to go on YouTube. So keep an eye on that. It's going to get a lot cooler in the near future. Yeah, but that's where we are right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, with that, I personally am really excited about our YouTube channel. And that's all I have to say about that.
It's going to be fun. And, you know, it's a place, too, where people, like, you know, there's more engagement, like, comment-wise and stuff. So it's a fun place that we can actually, you know, talk to listeners and stuff. So,
yeah, you can't really comment on a podcast episode,
Dude,
which would be awesome if you could.
I think they just added that to Spotify. I think that's a new thing. I don't know if it's, like, for certain creators, but I think they did. Somebody try it, please.
Oh, I want. I want.
Which is good.
That's amazing. But, Michael, this was a great episode. I had a ton of fun with this.
Al has rated this episode 5 stars.
Oh, yes. Folks, if you also like this episode, we would appreciate if you would give us a friendly review over on Apple Podcasts. Mm-hmm. You can hit the 5 stars, and if you want to write something, that does even better. Now, the reason why we keep plugging this is because, again, it does help us get in front of a lot more ear holes that way when you take that time. And so we really deeply appreciate getting your feedback. On Spotify, you can click that little star rating. Bing, bonk, 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 bonk. If you can put up to 5, that would be so very delicious for us. If it was just Michael, he'd be like, give us a 1 if you want.
They know how I feel. I want honesty above all.
Yeah.
But
I want more ear holes above all.
I know.
Like, I mean, like, for myself.
Oh,
for myself.
Like,
Michael,
to hear more.
Oh, no, yeah. I'm fine with honest reviews. I'm literally just looking to have a surgery.
Can you
where
imagine?
Where I can get...
I'd be the worst. You'd hear so
much.
No,
I think it'd be the best. I'd be totally fine with that. Yeah, exactly. So, Michael, with this weird, bizarre ending, why don't you send us off here?
All right. Here we go. And until next time, may the Force be with you.
And may the stars light your way.